From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn.
This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Gen X is a chemical found in the water, air, and soil around the company's plant in Fayetteville. Vince Winkle joins us now. He's a reporter with WHQR in Wilmington. He has been following this very closely. Welcome back, Vince.
Thanks, Frank. Never a dull moment in the Cape Fear region.
And no, that wasn't an intro glitch. You are actually listening to Coastline. But we're talking with Frank Stacio, who's hosted the State of Things, WUNC's public affairs program, since 2006.
Jackie Shelton Green was recently named Poet Laureate for the state of North Carolina. Heitor Villa-Lobos is regarded as perhaps the most famous classical composer of South America. Cash Michaels considers himself the Black Associated Press for North Carolina. Branford Marsalis came to our studio. He's a world-famous saxophonist, bandleader, and composer. Joining me for the update is political junkie Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
But his start in public radio came much earlier, in Ames, Iowa, at WOI. His next stop after Iowa, National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., where he eventually became a newscaster on All Things Considered. Today, we're going to learn more about his time in Washington, his launch of an alternative school, what it's like to be a national guest anchor on Talk of the Nation. Also, 13 years in, what still gets him excited with State of Things? Frank Stacio, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. And just a reminder for our listeners, this conversation is pre-recorded. You started in radio at 19?
That's right, with Marconi. He invented radio, and I said, could I have the first job? And he said, yes. No, I was...
You had me for a minute there. Wait a minute. How could this be possible?
He could be that old. 19 years old, yeah. I was in college, actually going to school, studying broadcasting, and had a job at what was then the 28th largest market in the country, Buffalo, New York.
And what kind of a format was it?
It was an album-oriented rock format, which meant we were playing records that went longer than 44 minutes, basically. And I was the news guy, so I was the least appreciated member of the staff, but... They had to do it because back then you had a responsibility to do news.
And how did you go from there to Ames, Iowa?
I just kept quitting radio. Nobody has quit radio more than me. I quit school. I left school and I had this job as a news director at the age of 19, which was kind of a big deal for a 19-year-old kid to be actually earning that kind of money and having a real job. And I just got tired of it all. I'd been working for probably 18 months, and I just was exhausted. But it was not what I wanted to do. I was just reading news copy, rewriting news copy, and writing stories that weren't terribly interesting to me. And I thought there was more I could do. And to do that, I would just do less by becoming unemployed. It was a bad plan. It was a bad plan.
It seemed to have worked out.
If it was a plan, it would have worked out. But the fact is it just was a lot of trial and error and making the road by walking, as they say. And so eventually, you know, I had to get a job, and the only thing I could do was radio. And I began to send out resumes and got a job in Iowa, WHO, in fact, which was a commercial station, then an all-news format. I was no more pleased with the profession and what I was doing in it then than I was when I quit, but I had to eat. And by then, I had a small family, a wife and a little girl. But there was a public radio station nearby. So I was in Des Moines, and Ames, Iowa, was just up the road. And talked to them and got a job in public radio, and that's how that happened.
You eventually found your way to the mothership in Washington, D.C., what we think of as NPR. And how did you start there? You were a producer?
Yeah. Then it was called the Acquisitions Unit. It is now the National Desk. And the idea was that there would be producers with editors and producers who would have a region in the country. Mine was the Midwest. And you would try to develop a stable of reporters, a lot of them station members, many freelancers, and some contract reporters, and try to bring in material from around the country onto All Things Considered. And so we were the ones who wrangled that in my region. Was the Midwest.
And that's not so different from the concept now. It's probably very different in practice, but the way NPR has bureau chiefs.
That's right.
Kind of do the same thing
yep.
with
yep.
member stations.
Yep.
And so then how did you move into becoming a newscaster from that job?
I quit. I quit again.
There seems to be an emerging theme here.
How much of the story to tell? So I was NPR, you know, had this catastrophic crash in 1983. We practically went bankrupt in 1983. We laid off two-thirds of our staff, and it looked like the end for us. And a lot of people left. I managed to maintain my job partly because I could go on the air, and so NPR took three jobs and melded them into one. This was special events production. They were producers, they were editors, and then there were on-air people who would do the live coverage of hearings and that sort of thing. Any kind of special coverage that might be live, that was a whole unit that did that. Well, that unit, after the crash, became me because I could actually figure out how to get the thing on the air and also anchor it. So they saved a lot of money, and that saved my job at NPR. The problem was they didn't have any money to do the events, so I wasn't actually doing anything, even though we'd gotten down to one person. I was bored, so I decided to do some reporting just on my own. And housing was the other catastrophic problem in the nation at the time, among many, was housing and homelessness. So I decided to make housing my beat. I did a lot of reporting, and when there were special events we could afford, I would do those. After about a year and a half of that, I went to Robert Siegel, who was then, at that time, he was the vice president for news. And I said, Robert.
Was he on the air at that point?
He was not. This is before he did All Things Considered. He had been a reporter and then at that point was vice president for news. I said, Bob, I've been doing all this stuff and I think it's time for a raise. And he said, Frank, you have, and it's been excellent, and we don't give merit raises. So I said, well, if you can't, that's fine, but then I got to go. So I wrote the letter, and I gave him a month. And then I bought a house.
In
the
Washington?
Same month, yeah.
Because you had faith in the decision they were going to make?
Because the interest rates finally fell below double digits. So, no, I had no faith. I knew he was absolutely right. There was nothing he could do. He's a great guy. I love Bob. And he was very appreciative of what I'd done, but he couldn't. His hands were tied. So the month is running out. Now, one thing they wanted me to do was become a newscaster. And they had been after me for a long time to read the news. And I said, I'm not a reader. I'm not a news reader. That if I will be typecast as a guy with a nice voice, and around here, that equates to, not having the stuff to be anything else. And it's a sad thing, but it's like a very handsome or attractive actor or actress who you think is only pretty and can't act. And I said, I'm not going to do it. So I went into his office and I said, okay, how about the newscaster thing? And he said, yeah, sure. So we worked that out, and that's how I became a newscaster.
And so you were making more money than just being the pretty face the pretty voice.
Not only that, but I made more money than I asked for in the original proposal, because as a newscaster, that was a big bump. I mean, not the money that was the only issue, but it was I needed to know that they had any sense of appreciation for what I was doing. And if they didn't, that was okay. I could work for UPS or whatever. I was fine with it.
Being a newscaster is still a very different thing from reporting and then producing a story and using tape and, creatively putting something together. Did you get nervous that first time that you were live on the air doing a newscast nationally?
Terrified. And I had been on the air before. I'd done a lot of newscasts. But as when you're doing a live show, you've got posts to hit. You really have to be out on the second. You don't have any grace, especially with newscasts. We couldn't come up with music or any of that. And it was NPR, for goodness sake. So, people knew how to put nouns and verbs in the right order and actually knew what the story was, so you'd better get it right. Terrified for months.
Did you ever mispronounce somebody's name that in hindsight you think you should have known, or mispronounce a word? Like, I once heard somebody say, for years I thought the word misled was misled. I mean, was there ever anything like that?
Or an acetylene torch? I've heard other. No, there's not. Nothing comes to mind. Like when I was in Iowa, we had these very strange names. Like NEVADA, Iowa, is Nevada. You would think it's Nevada, wouldn't you? MADRID, Iowa, is Madrid. So that so then I couldn't get those right.
And sounds like a good solid Midwest pronunciation.
Yeah, it's because we're not those fancy pants Europeans. We got crescents. We don't do croissants here. That was the whole vibe there, and it was a wonderful place. God bless them all. But there's a river that had a Native American name, and it was giant. And I looked at it, and I just opened my mouth and let the sounds come out.
You took a shot.
Took a shot, just because I hadn't seen it before. And I said, Wapsipinicon River has risen three feet above crest or whatever. And then I looked at my co-host, who was from Iowa, and we went into a break, and I shrugged and said, okay, what is it? And his jaw dropped. He said, no, it's Wapsipinicon. How'd you get that right? So,
wow.
Yeah, so who knows? But Madrid and Nevada could never know.
So was there another career? I mean, when you think back to the 19-year-old who started in radio in Buffalo, if you could live another life and have another career, would you be a musician? Is that what it is? What would it have been?
Well, here's the thing. There's a couple of ways to answer that. Number one, at 19, there wasn't an answer. I thought I wanted to be a writer.
Really? What kind of a writer?
A drunk writer. They drank a lot, and I thought, that's really cool. And that part, I got that down, but the problem was the writing. That was not so good. No, you know, but then, I mean, it was the 60s. We were still hungover from the sort of the Kerouac era. There was a lot of free-form writing and this kind of exploring America. So I was going to be that guy.
And we're going to hear more about that when we come back. You're listening to Coastline. Frank Stacio, host of WUN State of Things, is my guest today. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Frank Stacio has hosted the State of Things out of WUNC since 2006. He's with us today to talk in part about his career, a significant part of which was spent at NPR in Washington, D.C. And just a reminder that today's conversation is pre-recorded. Frank, just before we went to break, you were explaining that at 19 you wanted to be a drunk writer.
Mm-hmm.
Was this nonfiction, fiction, poetry?
Fiction. I imagined myself, you know, sort of one of the great American novelists who would tell the whole story of this complex, vast nation of ours.
And so once that dream was shattered, mm-hmm. I was guessing at music.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted something to do in the music yep. industry as a musician because that is so much a part of your show today, and mm-hmm. it really seems to be a part of the fire in your belly. So that's in your future.
Well, here's the thing. When I did get steered to radio, I mean, again, I'm gonna be a writer. I'm going to figure out how to do that. I go to college. Friend says, hey, you know, we got a radio station here. Went down. I got a show, but I was, again, not terribly interested in being a DJ so much. Once I realized how all this stuff worked and, you know, how you could patch one thing into another, and there's the microphone, there's the tape deck, and, oh, what does that machine do? It changes the quality of the sound in various ways. I started listening to records, understanding kind of the back end of it, how the record got made, and I got really interested in the choices that record producers make. Because I realize now that the Beatles just didn't get in there and start strumming away. They strummed, and then they added stuff, and somebody made some really important decisions about how much bass and how much treble and whether Paul should do an overdub. And that's what I wanted to do. And all I've ever wanted to do, Rachel, and this is the honest-to-goodness truth, really, in radio, all I've ever wanted to do is be a record and recording engineer. Like, just be the guy who fools with, at that time, pots, but now they're faders. To get the sound just right.
When are you going to do that?
I'm working on it now because the good news is that would cost tens of thousands of dollars to equip your studio to do that. And now, you know, for tens of thousands of cents, you can do it in your own living room. So, you know, if you have a digital audio workstation and you can start to understand how these little digital tools work, you can do it at home. And that's what I'm doing now, is kind of learning how to do it. And the good news is, since I have a career and I'm already, for better or for worse, it's on the record. That's what Frank Stacio did for a living. look at it. So I never have to get good at it. I don't have to get good at this. I can just have the pure joy of getting better at it without ever having to, you know, show anybody I'm good enough to hire.
And other than a job and a career, what advantage does that give you? Is there some advantage in approaching your actual job with that kind of freedom?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, actually. It's not just the aesthetic, you know, sort of becoming better tuned to audio and hearing those minute, subtle differences that make all the difference. Yeah, it makes me know that I'm... So one of the biggest risks in any profession is to identify with your job. If you are your job, I think it's a huge risk, because if anything goes wrong, you're annihilated. Yeah. It's over. If they lay you off because they're out of money, you have just lost your identity. So I spent a whole life trying not to do that. And the idea that I could be good at and terribly interested in something that's not going to pay my rent gives me great comfort.
How has state of things changed for you when you think back to 2006, when you first took it over as the permanent host? At this point, you already had experience as a talk show host. You sat in as guest anchor for Talk of the Nation. And I do want to ask you about that, because you say that you didn't just slide into that job. There was a learning curve, and you also faced some stage fright, which I think our listeners would be relieved to hear. You're human.
It was scary.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
But with state of things, has it changed from 2006 to the way you approach it now?
It changed in 2006 from what it had been. I mean, you talked about music. I mean, one of the things I thought we needed to do was have music once a week, live music once a week, to reflect the state of North Carolina's abundant musical talent and richness and history. And we spend more time on... making sure that we reflect the intellectual, the cultural, the political, and the social story of North Carolina. It is rich, it is deep, it is varied, and it takes a lot of work. And as your producers will attest to this, they do a lot of that kind of finding all that material and bringing it to the show. And so that was the sea change in 2006. That's what I wanted the show to be. That wasn't easy. What we've done since then is add a greater emphasis on actual news, particularly from the State House. We just weren't doing as much of it. It meant building a more robust news department as well. And so we all worked together as a team, the whole station, to kind of build an infrastructure that could support a better news output on our show.
And you do have some really excellent journalism coming out of WUNC. This is a challenging state. It's a purple state.
Yeah.
And you are actually embedded in probably one of the bluest parts of the state.
Right.
But you're reporting on red government,
right,
largely, and this purple populace. So how do you approach that, reporting to a divided audience? Or do you see your audience that way?
Well, I mean, I don't. It is divided. It's surprising when you look at the numbers, because I think people assume that this is a sort of a liberal or a left-leaning news outlet that talks to a left-leaning audience. Surprising the number of people who identify Republican who say they listen to NPR. And it comes pretty close to, it starts approaching 50% when you do that poll. So, But that said, that's none of my concern. I really don't care who's listening. Our job is to hold power accountable to the people who put them into power. People in power accountable to the people who put them there. Sometimes that might make us look a little liberal, particularly if you have a conservative government. Then you're always asking them hard questions, and if they're all conservative, it seems to people like you're really picking on the conservatives, therefore you must be liberal. But mostly you're concerned with the fact that they're in power, and there are very serious questions about how they developed this policy, how much time did you take, how many people did you consult. All of that's a fair question, and we'd like to hold their feet to the fire. So I try to apply the principles of journalism to our approach, and then let the audience figure out who I am and what I mean by it.
You know, this is actually a national example of this, but it's such a good one because we've heard from so many people that they were just kind of shocked in the aftermath of the delivery of the Mueller report. And it was a recent New York Times opinion piece. Columnist David Leonhardt unpacked some of the problematic coverage leading up to the delivery of the Mueller report to Attorney General William Barr. And he criticized cable news and other news outlets like BuzzFeed, I think, for wild speculation. And he says that the newsrooms covering the investigation most closely, and he names the New York Times and the Washington Post, generally did an excellent job distinguishing among fact, uncertainty, and falsehood. But he points out the coverage at the end of that investigation was problematic for many reasons, including overstating what the Attorney General said about the report. And again, I'm bringing this up because we heard from some listeners that they felt almost misled in the coverage leading up to that report. And for me, it was reminiscent of the aftermath of the 2016 presidential election when there were many people across the country who went, wait, this isn't the story that was being told leading up to the November election. What lesson do you think that we need to be taking from these events as journalists?
Well, I don't know that we don't already know the lessons. I mean, the lessons are, you know, make sure you have the data before you report it as data. If people are terribly interested in something you don't have the whole story on, let them know that it's coming, but here, you know, it's we don't have it yet. So the lessons are the same. The pressures are greater, and I think the standards, even among the audience writ large, the larger audience, have slipped a little bit in terms of what they accept as true, not true speculation. Of course, good old social media is going to come in for some criticism on this. Things get out there just too quickly, and opinion and fact have merged now in a way that I'm not sure we're going to ever pull them apart. So nothing that we do should have changed. Some of it has. We are reporting things too quickly. We're trying way too quickly to get the tweet out before we can assemble the data and analyze it ourselves, put it in context. We're moving too fast. We should stop moving too fast and get back to the place where we were when we were better at it. Because in answer to your question, we've already learned those lessons.
Right. And yeah. So why do you think world-class journalists get caught up in those basic mistakes?
Because they see their whole business slipping to these other platforms, and these other platforms are moving literally at the speed of light. Right.
And, you know, a much less complicated example of this is that the gas explosion that happened in Durham just a few days ago. And there was one death, and I think the latest on the injury toll is up to about 25.
Around 25 people are hospitalized, yeah.
Yeah.
And released later, yeah.
So this is an example of breaking news, which isn't something that public radio covers on a regular basis. And some people might even argue that it's not really a sweet spot for public radio dealing with breaking news. But you guys had to deal with that. It was right in your backyard, and this became an international story. So how do you approach that? How do you make sure that you're reporting only what you have at this point in a story like that that's not fraught with politics?
Right. But well, I mean, again, we have – so the way you approach it as an organization is to make sure you have enough people to do the job. And this is the sadness and the grief of our entire industry, where the greatest the brain trust and the repository of skill and experience was in our newspapers. And if public radio stations weren't so good at covering local news, it's because we considered ourselves a kind of secondary source. The newspapers would cover it, and then we would talk about it, and we would put it in context. And that's what public radio did forever. And that's what people were tuning in for, especially at the local level. Those papers have now we now have more reporters. WUNC has more reporters at the State House than the News and Observer, than McClatchy. Than the McClatchy chain. WRAL-TV has two, and WUNC has two reporters. So two broadcast outlets have more than the newspapers. We're it. We're it. And so in public radio, especially at the local level, we have to understand that we have to move up to the front lines, hire enough people who have some kind of experience. Jason De Bruin, who did our live coverage, actually came from the Triangle Business Journal. He's a print reporter. So he knows the rules. He knows the rules. If a lot of people are standing around him saying, I heard that she went, and he can hear that, but he's going to verify it before he talks to me on the radio about it. He's got that experience. So I think we have to, as an industry, be willing to commit the money to hire the people to do the training and make sure that we don't lose all of that experience in the industry and have to invent the wheel all over again. Because if we try to craft rules and craft experience in the social media age, those rules are going to look very different and it's not going to yield a good product.
You're listening to Coastline. It's conversation with Frank Stacio, host of The State of Things, which airs here on WHQR weekdays at 1 p.m. Today's discussion is pre-recorded. In the very beginning of this show, we played some sound from State of Things, including a clip from your introduction of WHQR's own Vince Winkle. WUNC has frequently called on Vince. The State of Things has called on Vince because of his coverage of Gen X. How do you see, why is it that you call on Vince Winkle for that content instead of using WUNC's own reporters?
Well, he's here and we're not. And this is the great, to me, is the great benefit of our collaboration since we've started to collaborate. And I talked a few minutes ago about the importance of public radio stations understanding the value of news at the local level. WHQR has already figured that out. Good for us, sitting in Raleigh, when a story like that breaks, to know that, you know, when there's a hurricane or an ongoing story like Gen X and contamination, there are people down here who are experienced, expert, and on the scene who we can rely on as our partners in what should never have been a competitive industry, sadly. It should never have been a competitive industry, but because it became a form of, you know, not a public trust, but a kind of a capitalist enterprise from the get-go, it was competitive. It isn't anymore. It can't be anymore. We see those kinds of collaborations, and I'm so grateful that WHQR is here. And, of course, we have a partner up in the mountains, Blue Ridge Public Radio. We rely on them. They rely on us. It's in that sense, things are getting much better, that these hard times have actually forced us to rethink how we do business, and I think we're doing it better.
Yeah, and I think Hurricane Florence is an example of that because we were able across the state to pool the resources. And you mentioned Jason De Bruin doing the coverage of the Durham gas explosion. He actually, you guys shared him with us, and he came here for a couple of days
to
help us.
And you were in this building while everything was falling apart and washing away into the ocean, and you were here, actually, I think, unbathed and unfed. And
you could smell us in Durham.
I think I had a sense that you hadn't been out in a while. I don't know what it was. No, but it was – and you're here. And trained journalists who get what it means to cover the story, and we're just grateful. That's all.
And I want to go back to your time when you first started guest hosting a national talk show while you were still in Washington, D.C., because you got the call and this wasn't necessarily something
right
that was in your wheelhouse, or at least your wheelhouse of experience.
Right.
But you took it on anyway. Tell
well,
us
the thing
that.
Was I had been teaching. We started a school 6 years earlier, and the school then lost its funding for, you know, strictly political reasons, but it was gone. And I quit NPR I quit again. No one has quit radio more than me. And this time I actually left the building. And I helped to start the school in Washington, D.C. for at-risk kids. And we did it for 6 years. And then it was gone. And now I've got a freelance, so I'll take any job I can get. And I get a call from WAMU, the local station there. They had a syndicated show. Derek McGinty was doing the show. And he left. Could I fill in while they find the host? And they said, you can do a talk show, can't you? And in my mind, I said no. And what I said on the phone was yes, because I needed money. I had to work. I didn't have a job. So I said yes. And then I get there, and I'm thinking, my goodness, I've got 2 hours of air to hold just me, and I'm not reading, you know, a script for 5 minutes, 45-second stories. You got to go back and forth and engage in conversation, and I was terrified, absolutely terrified.
How many producers did you have at that point?
I think they had, for that show, I remember it was 2 hours. I think we had like 3.5 producers.
So they broke it up into segments, and you had guests come into the studio.
Yeah.
Have you ever been sitting across from a guest, and I mean, back then or now, when you've just looked at them and thought, I have no idea where to go next, and we have 5 minutes left. Has that happened?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what do you do?
Well, I call it lobbing a grenade or breaking the glass. The other thing, I remember David Letterman once saying that what he felt his job was to do was he said this is back in the days when TV did have glass, TV screen. He said, there's this thick wall of glass between me and you, and I feel like every night I just need to break that glass and smash it and come into your living room. And I feel like, okay, we've been talking politely about your career or your discovery or whatever it was in your laboratory that you found so interesting, and I can tell nobody else cares. So now what do we do? And I'll just say something like, you know, did you ever spill something in the lab and it just burned a hole in the floor? And you had to call the fire department. And this strange thing, if you do that, the answer is always yes. And it's like this, you know, Frank, it's funny you should say that, but and it's like a good thing because I'm out of stuff.
So that helps you break the glass.
It breaks the glass. It breaks me. It breaks me open. It's like, okay, I can get off the script and go somewhere. And if I'm lucky, it will. But if not, at least my mind is now more open to other things to ask.
You cover a lot of territory on a weekly basis because State of Things is usually broken up into three different segments. Right. Is that right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a lot of content, a lot of different topics. And when we come back from this break, we're going to find out.
I'm going to name 15 of them right now, and then you can come back from your break.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3. State of Things host Frank Statio is with us today. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Frank Statio has served as the host of State of Things out of WUNC in Durham's historic American Tobacco District for more than a dozen years. Before that, he worked at NPR in Washington, D.C. as a newscaster, among other roles for All Things Considered. And he started an alternative school while he was in D.C. He's with us today to explore his career, lessons learned, and how he keeps the fire in his belly stoked. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. Frank Statio, just before we went to break, we were talking about the breadth of topics that you cover on a weekly basis. Are there ever times that you look at what you have to tackle on a particular day and you just think, I could not be less interested in this, really? How am I going to get through this?
No, but that's because I have a lot to say about what gets on the show. We have four dedicated producers and a dedicated engineer, and we meet twice a day to talk about things. Producers bring things to the table, as do I, and we talk them through. So by the time it gets to air, and I will say that nobody's ideas get shot down more than mine, mostly because they seem flaky and just too abstract.
What's an example of an idea that you had that got shot
down
that you still think is legit and they need to do?
There's a couple things. There's one silly one that I think is great. The silly one that I think is great is it's just so I talked to the chancellor of a former chancellor of this UNC Chapel Hill. And I can't think of his name right now. It's really embarrassing because he was just before Carol Fold. Who preceded Carol Fold?
I should know this too.
Well, anyway, so and my apologies because he's a terrific guy and he was the chemist. The point was he's a chemist, and I'm embarrassed that I've forgotten his name. And they said, well, let's have him on the air and talk to him. And I thought, you can't have the chancellor of the university on because they can't say anything. And I'm going to be talking to this man who I respect for 12 minutes, and he won't be able to say anything because he's so constrained and so worried about saying the wrong thing. That's a terrible interview. And they said, now we got to do it, you know. And we'll do it for Duke, too. And when these incoming chancellors, we should meet them for a moment. All right, bring them up. So we do. And as I say, wonderful guy. And I have nothing but respect and admiration. However, you know, education, Frank, is very important. And, you know, the youth and the synergies that we can bring to all of our bringing business and, and money and people together. It's that kind of thing. So finally, I said, you know, you're a chemist. And I know that you're just starting a job, and I know you don't want to pick favorites, but I got it. And I could see the blood draining from his face. I'm going to ask him a really embarrassing question, put him on the spot, and he's just about to pass out. And I said, but you got to tell me, what's your favorite element on the periodic table? No, you're laughing. What he says is, oh, ruthenium. I said, wait a minute, you've got an answer for this? He said, yeah, ruthenium. He said, I got placemats made for my kid. I've got the whole molecular structure. If that's what happens to atoms. I don't think atoms can have a molecular structure, but the atomic structure of ruthenium. And I said, well, now I've got to ask a follow-up. I wasn't prepared for this, but okay, why? He says, well, ruthenium has got this amazing property. It's a good conductor, apparently, and you can use it in experiments because it has very low resistance, and so it's a really good conductor. And if you want to do other experiments, you need to know your ruthenium. Oh, man, I just had not expected a guy to have a favorite element. I'm at a wedding. A few months later, I meet a guy. He's a chemist. I tell him the story. I expect him to laugh the same way you and everybody else does when I get to the punchline.
Right, the non-chemist, yeah.
Yeah, the chemist, he rolls his eyes. He said, well, what'd he say? I said, ruthenium. He rolls his eyes and like throws his hands in the air. I said, did you just diss ruthenium? I said, well, it's not bad, but I said, oh, well, okay, so what's yours? He said, lawrencium. So... the lawrencium apparently is something that, you know, you heat to a certain point, it gets hotter and hotter, and then for some crazy reason it gets cooler, and then it gets hotter again. I think that's how he explained it to me. The chemist out there, if I'm wrong, I apologize, but that's how I understood it. So, to answer your question, I would like to now poll chemists to find out what is their favorite element, because there are these great stories. And I've talked to a number of chemists since they all have one.
So I bet you're right. And, you know, that doesn't sound so silly to me, which is how you characterized it when we started mm-hmm. this. It actually sounds like it would be a pretty interesting right. way in to some of the more obscure elements that we don't necessarily talk about or have heard of. I think that's great.
Exactly. Well, the staff just won't have it. Now, on the other side of that, when I get really serious, that's when they really roll their eyes. And
what makes you get really serious?
Well, for instance, I wanted to do a show, and we finally did it, but it took me literally years. I said, I think the nation state is finished. I think this is what we're really seeing now is the end of the nation state. So we had the divine right of kings. We had aristocracy. It ended. We get this kind of democracy thing. It's over. The nation state was the handmaiden of capitalism. Capitalism has moved on. It no longer needs the nation state to guard its supply lines as it once did, to socialize the cost of the capitalist supply line and to privatize the profit. That's what a nation state did. Global capital means we don't need the nation state anymore. You can see it. Capitalists hate tariffs. They don't even like Donald Trump that much because he doesn't represent anymore what the true capitalist is about. And I said, and capitalism rules the world, not nation states. I think it's over. Let's do the show. And they gave me the same look you did. What are you talking about? What on earth are you talking about? Nation state. It took me, and we did a show. It was pretty good, wasn't it? It was pretty good.
You're on the fence, though, about it could have been better. You sound iffy.
Well, here's the thing. I thought it was great
okay.
because I was deeply interested in this. But if you haven't been reading a lot, and there are a lot of people who have written very thoughtfully about what the nation state did, how it functions, and how it is no longer, that a lot of what we're seeing and a lot of the divisions that we're seeing is precisely the fact that the nation doesn't represent all the people in it. And nations often, especially a nation like England, everybody spoke the same language. They were primarily the same race. And so it was a lot easier for them to form a cohesive political and social unit. That doesn't exist anymore. And therefore, that's part of what we're seeing. And we can't get it through our head that this form of social organization doesn't have to be. It hasn't been with us. It's only been with us for about 300, 400 years. and it can go away. So if you
and which way does it need to go?
Well, that's the thing. That's why you have the conversation. Where? What would it be? What would it be next?
Where would you take it if you were in charge?
Oh, it would be true anarchy, not anarchy as in chaos. Anarchy as in each of us weighing in on issues that are relevant to us at the time. And so you might have a water board deciding how the Cape Fear should be polluted or not, and who's responsible for that. And then a whole other form of organization that would take a look at how goods are made and traded and all that sort of thing. The idea of national boundaries seems silly to me. We can see the capital, for instance, is free to fly borders without any interruption, without any stop. No border guards, no immigration and customs. The dollar flies wherever it can make a better dollar. A pepper grower in Mexico cannot get the highest return on his or her work in the same way that a dollar can get the highest return on theirs. So the national boundary is a kind of silly idea, and it only hurts people, not dollars. So why don't we come up with a way to obliterate those and make things more equitable for people on all sides who are very willing to work very, very hard, but not for somebody else.
Did you try to do the end of the nation state in a single segment?
In a single show, we spent an hour.
And the difficulty there, as you were starting to say, is people who haven't thought about this or followed it, you have to bring them up to speed. And then how do you get to the level of depth that is happening in your brain?
It's a little bit like that. So either it's very hard to follow the explanation, or the whole exposition getting you there was a little dreary.
Yeah.
So it was not a highly successful show. It turns out in that case, the staff was right, I think. I mean, it's a great idea. I think we should all think deeply about it, but perhaps we weren't ready for it on our show.
Well,
the periodic table? I want to do that tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Okay, we'll be tuning in for that. We're talking with a host of The State of Things, Frank Statio. The State of Things airs on WHQR weekdays at 1 p.m. here in the Cape Fear region. So another topic that can be difficult to do via radio is when you're talking about animals. And I've noticed, because you have the luxury of having the Duke Lemur Center.
Yeah.
In your region, you get to do stories about lemurs.
That.
And you did one recently called, near the end of last year, How Lemurs May Hold the Key to Healthy Aging and Even More Space Travel. The newer news is that they had a baby recently. I don't think that was on State of Things yet. But you did How Lemurs May Hold the Key to Healthy Aging and Even More Space Travel. How do you tackle something like that and capture lemur magic on the radio?
Well, luckily, and I think all the universities have finally caught on to this, they've got public scholars who know how to talk about their work, right? They hire people, and the top-tier universities are doing this. They're making sure that the people who can do top-tier research can also are charismatic. So we also talk about dinosaurs. You know, we have Lindsay Zano on regularly from the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences talking about her research on dinosaurs. You know, it's got the ancestor to the T-Rex, et cetera. These folks know how to bring it. They know how to have fun with it, and they know how to explain it, and that makes it easy. And, of course, we're interested. I mean, we want to know that these, you know, lemurs hibernate, but they hibernate in ways that bears don't. And so what a bear has a wake-up mechanism, and everybody understands how it works. Nobody knows how the lemur wakes up. And since they're a primate, it may be that we have the capability genetically to find that little gene that may have gone dormant in us, turn it on, and then go to sleep for 100 years or so and go to Mars, whatever that takes. I don't think it takes 100 years to go to Mars. But
when you were talking about your conversation with the former chancellor and how your team was
Holden,
reminding you.
Holden, keep going.
we'll get it. And your team was saying that's not going to be a good interview because of his position, because of the position he's in. It's highly politicized, and he's so hamstrung in terms of what he can and will say.
Right.
You still, as part of your job, have to talk with people
Right.
who are in those kinds of positions. And I actually had the luxury of having a conversation with Robert Siegel before he retired from All Things Considered about this, and talking with politicians, Right. which is almost a daily part of his life. before he called it quits. How do you kind of poke through that veneer of talking points and get to a human being?
I don't know that I've ever been successful at it. I just don't think Robert is very good at it. I think Diane Rehm was one of the best at it when she was doing her show. I don't think I'm very good at it. I try. I ask the questions. We had a success story just recently because we talked to the sheriff of Henderson County for 20 minutes, and it was just 2 weeks ago. And again, I made the same caution to the staff. I said, this is an elected official, and, you know, this is going to be tough, so let's do a lot of research. The best way to handle it is to have data. On January, you said this, and then in March, you said this. Those two things aren't the same. What do you truly believe? Or you know. So as much data as you can bring, or the more data you can bring to the conversation, the tougher it's going to be. If you're asking for opinions and you don't have any data, you are stuck with their answer. So that's one thing. But in this case, it was interesting because he was on the fence about 287G. He had been elected and unseated the sheriff who had served for many, many years on a much more lenient stand toward immigration in a very conservative county in North Carolina.
The newly elected sheriff had that more lenient stance.
More lenient. He complained about 287G. He said he wasn't sure he was going to renew it. There was a lot wrong with it, and he wanted to build a better relationship with the Latino community, and these programs with the feds interfered with that. He was very clear. So I said, well, it's up in June. What are you going to do? He said, well, I'm pretty sure I'm going to sign up again, but I've got my reservations. I'm still on the fence. I said, well, what would make you make your decision? So, I mean, I stuck with it a little bit. How are you going to make your decision? What's going to change between now and June? What are you going to be looking at between now and June? If you keep asking the question the same way, it's a little like in basketball where you can, you know, if you keep throwing the ball around, eventually the defense, I don't play basketball, but I've seen this happen, where if their defense is there and you keep moving the ball around enough, somebody's out of place and you take the shot. So you can do that. You can get people out of position. Interestingly enough, we got a call from our partners, Blue Ridge Public Radio, who said the Latino communities in Henderson County are now up in arms. They heard the interview. Leaders in that community thought that they had been lied to, essentially, and have called the sheriff to account. And there are now a lot of public meetings going on in Henderson County over this in Latino communities after the interview. So... they do some good if you just sort of do the work and don't expect the Perry Mason moment. You don't remember Perry Mason. Perry Mason was a defense lawyer, and his client didn't do it, but who did? And at the very last moment, the actual perpetrator would stand up and make a tearful confession. On the stand, you know, Perry would say, wasn't it you who had the crowbar? And it was, you know, and then they would tearfully admit the whole crime. We never get the Perry Mason moment in this business. And so you have to just do your job and hope that, you know, someday it's that it all adds up.
Do you hear other stories like that, that after the fact, after you've done something on the air, had a discussion or pulled back the curtain on an issue, that there's change? Or is that a pretty rare occurrence?
It's pretty rare.
Yeah.
How about you? Because you're doing, I think, very important work here, which is keeping our eye on the coastline and making sure that all the questions about our environment are that people are accountable to what is the public's good. And this is the hard part about the commons, right? What do we do about the air? Who owns that? And what do we do about the water? Has that happened for you?
And that's this edition of Coastline.
See, I didn't. If I could have the clock in front of me, I would have asked that earlier.
Yeah, well, see, we can't take credit for any of that. We just do our work, and then things happen as they do.
Okay.
Frank Stasio, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
What an honor. Good to talk with you. Thank you.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you miss part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.